Chapter 30. An hour later he stopped in front of a small inn. He was very hungry and his head felt numb. He parked the car in front of the building where there were two tables and a few chairs. He ordered coffee and brioche and went to wash. The washroom stank. He asked for a glass and washed out his mouth. Then he washed his hands and went back. Breakfast was on the table. The coffee smelled like all the breakfasts in the world. Swallows flew along the roofs, and the sun hung its first golden tapestries on the walls of the houses. People were going to work, and a maid with skirt drawn up was scrubbing the floors behind the beaded curtains of the bistro. It was the most peaceful summer morning Ravitch had seen in a long time. He drank the hot coffee, but he could not make up his mind to eat. He did not want to touch anything with his hands. He looked at them. Nonsense, he thought. Damnation, I'm not going to start getting complexes. I must eat. He drank another cup of coffee. He took a cigarette out of his pack and took pains not to put the end he had touched into his mouth. I can't go on this way, he thought, but nevertheless he did not eat anything. I must get entirely through with it first, he thought, and got up and paid. A herd of cows, butterflies, the sun over the fields, the sun on the glass of the windshield, the sun on the top of the car, the sun on the glittering metal of the trunk under which Harker lay, killed without having heard why and by whom. It should have been different. "Do you recognize me, Harker? Do you know who I am?" He saw the red face before him. "No, why? Who are you? Have we met before?" "Yes." "When? Were we close friends? At officers' training school, perhaps? I don't remember." "You don't remember, Harker?" It was not at officers' training school, it was after that. After? But you've lived abroad. I have never been out of Germany, only in the last 2 years, here in Paris. Perhaps we drank... No, we did not drink together. And it wasn't here. In Germany, Harker. A barrier, railroad tracks, a garden, small roses, phlox and sunflowers. Waiting. A forlorn black train puffing through the endless morning. Reflected in the windshield, alive, the eyes that were now in the trunk, jelly-like and filling with dust that sifted in through the cracks. "In Germany? Ah, I understand. At one of the party rallies. Nuremberg. I think I remember. Wasn't it at the Nuremberger Hof?" "No, Harker." Ravitch spoke slowly into the glass of the windshield, and he felt the black wave of the years coming back. "Not in Nuremberg. In Berlin." "Berlin?" The shadowy face, broken by reflections, showed a trace of jovial impatience. "Now let's hear it, my friend. Let's hear the story. Stop beating about the bush and don't keep me on the rack any longer. Where was it?" The wave, up to his arms now, rising out of the earth. "On the rack, Harker. Just that, on the rack." A laugh, uncertain, wary. "I don't make jokes, my friend." "On the rack, Harker. Do you know now who I am?" The laughter, more uncertain, more wary, menacing. "How should I know? I see thousands of people. I can't remember each individual. If you're referring to the secret police..." "Yes, Harker. The Gestapo." A shrug of the shoulders, on his guard. "In case you were ever questioned there..." "Yes. Do you remember?" Once more a shrug of the shoulders. "How should I remember? We have questioned thousands, questioned, beaten into unconsciousness, kidneys crushed, bones broken, thrown into cellars like sacks, dragged up again, faces torn, testicles crushed. That was what you called questioning. The hot, frightful moaning of those who were no longer able to cry, questioned. The whimpering between unconsciousness and consciousness, kicks in the belly, rubber clubs, whips, yes, all that you innocently called questioning." Ravitch stared at the invisible face in the windshield through which the country landscape with corn and poppies and hedge-roses silently glided. He stared at it. His lips moved, and he said everything that he had wanted to say and hadn't said and had to say. "Don't move your hands, or I'll shoot you down. Do you remember little Max Rosenberg who lay beside me in the cellar with his torn body and who tried to smash his head on the cement wall to keep from being questioned again? Questioned? Why? Because he was a Democrat. And Willmann, who passed blood and had no teeth and only one eye left after he had been questioned by you for 2 hours. Questioned. Why? because he was a Catholic and did not believe your Führer was the new Messiah. And Riesenfeld, whose head and back looked like raw lumps of flesh, and who implored us to bite open his arteries because he was toothless and no longer able to do it himself after he had been questioned by you. Questioned. Why? Because he was against war and did not believe that culture is most perfectly expressed by bombs and flamethrowers. Questioned. Thousands have been questioned. Yes, don't move your hands, you swine. And now finally I've got you, and we are driving to a house with thick walls, and we will be all alone, and I'll question you. Slowly, slowly, for days, the Rosenberg treatment, the Willmann treatment, the Riesenfeld treatment, just as you have demonstrated it to us. And then, after all that... Suddenly Ravitch realized that the car was speeding. He let up on the accelerator. Houses, a village, dogs, chickens, horses in pasture galloping, their necks stretched, their heads lifted high, pagan, centaur-like, vigorous life. A laughing woman with a laundry basket, bright-coloured laundry dangling on the lines, flags of secure happiness. Children playing by the doors. He saw all this very clearly, and yet as if separated from it by a glass wall, very near and incredibly far, full of beauty and peace and innocence, painfully strong and severed from him, and now unattainable for ever because of this night. He felt no regret. It was this way, that was all. Drive slowly. The only chance of being stopped lay in speeding through the villages. The clock. He had been driving almost 2 hours. How was that possible? He had not been aware of it. He had not seen anything, only the face toward which he had spoken. Saint-Germain. The park. Black trellises against the blue sky, and then the trees. Trees. Avenues of trees. A park of trees. Looked for, desired, and suddenly the woods. The car ran more silently. The woods rose, a green and golden wave. They flung open on the right and left. They flooded the horizon and embraced everything, even the swift, glistening insect zigzagging into them. The ground was soft and overgrown with underbrush. It was far from the road. Ravitch left the car at a distance of about 100 meters so that he could see it. Then he took the spade and began to dig up the earth. It was easy. If someone came by and saw the car, he could hide the spade and return as a harmless stroller. He dug deep enough to have sufficient earth with which to cover the body. Then he drove the car to that spot. A dead body was heavy. Nevertheless, he drove only as far as the ground was hard so as to leave no tire marks. The body was still limp. He dragged it to the hole and began to tear off the clothes and to pile them in heaps. It was easier than he had thought. He left the naked body there, took the clothes, put them into the trunk, and drove the car back. He locked the doors and the trunk and took a hammer with him. He had to think of the possibility that the body would be found by accident, and he wanted to prevent identification. For a moment he found it difficult to go back. He felt an almost irresistible impulse to leave the corpse behind, to step into the car and race off. He stood for a while and looked about. A few yards away two squirrels chased each other on the trunk of a beech tree. Their red fur shone in the sun. He continued to walk. Bloated, bluish. He put a piece of woolen cloth soaked with oil over Harker's face and began to smash it with the hammer. After the first blow he stopped. It seemed to make a lot of noise. Then he immediately went on striking. After some time he lifted the piece of cloth. The face was an unrecognizable lump clotted with black blood. Like Riesenfeld's head, he thought. He felt his teeth set tight. It was not like Riesenfeld's head, he thought. Riesenfeld's head was worse. He was still alive. The ring on the right hand. He tore it off and pushed the body into the hole. The hole was a little too short. He bent the knees against the belly. Then he shoveled the earth on. It didn't take long. He stamped the earth flat and covered it with squares of moss he had already cut out with the spade. They fitted in. One could not see the edges unless one bent down. He straightened the underbrush. The hammer, the spade, the piece of cloth. He put them with the clothes in the trunk. Then he walked back once more, slowly, looking for telltale signs. He found almost none. Rain and a few days of growth would attend to what remained. Strange. a dead man's shoes, the socks, the underwear. The suit less so. The socks, the shirt, the underwear, ghost-like, withered, as if they had died with the man. It was ghastly to touch them and to look for monograms and labels. Ravitch did it quickly. He cut them out. Then he rolled the things into a bundle and buried them. He did this more than 10 kilometers away from the place where he had buried the corpse, far enough to prevent their both being found at the same time. He drove on until he reached a brook. He took the labels he had cut out and wrapped them in paper. Then he tore Harker's notebook into small pieces and searched the wallet. It contained 2 1,000-franc notes, the railroad ticket to Berlin, 10 marks, several slips of paper with addresses, and Harker's passport. Ravitch put the French money into his pocket. He had already found a few 5-franc notes in Harker's pocket. He looked at the railroad ticket for a moment. To Berlin. It was strange to see that. To Berlin. He tore it up and put it with the other things. He contemplated the passport for a long time. It was valid for 3 years more and had a visa valid for almost 2 years. He was tempted to keep it and use it himself. It would have fitted into the kind of existence he led. He would not have thought twice, except for the danger. He tore it up. The 10-mark bill, too. He kept Harker's keys, the revolver, the ring, and the receipt for Harker's suitcases. He wanted time to decide whether to call for the suitcases and thus wipe out every trace in Paris. He had found and torn up the hotel bill. He burned everything. It took longer than he had thought, but he had newspaper with which to burn the pieces of cloth. He threw the ashes into the brook. Then he examined the car for bloodstains. There were none. He washed the hammer and the monkey wrench carefully and put the tools back into the trunk. He washed his hands as well as he could, took a cigarette and sat for a while smoking. The sun shone obliquely through the high beech trees. Ravitch sat and smoked. He was empty and did not think about anything. Not until he turned again into the road that led to the chateau did he think of Sybil. In the bright summer, the chateau stood white under the eternal sky of the 18th century. Suddenly he thought of Sybil, and for the first time since those days he did not try to resist the memory, to push it aside and suppress it. He had never got further in his recollection than the day when Harker had called her in. He had never got further than the expression of horror and mad fear in her face. Everything else had been wiped out by that. And he had never got further than the news that she had hanged herself. He had never believed it. It was possible, but who knew what had happened to her before? He was never able to think of her without feeling a spasm in his brain that turned his hands into claws and compressed his breast like a cramp, making him incapable for days of escaping the red fog of powerless hope for revenge. He thought of her now, and the circle and spasm and the fog suddenly left him. Something had been released. A barrier had fallen. The rigid image of horror began to move. It was no longer frozen as it had been all these years. Her distorted mouth began to close, her eyes lost their fixity, and the blood gently returned to her chalk-white face. It was no longer an eternal mask of fear. It became again Sybil, whom he had known, with whom he had lived, whose tender breasts he had felt, and who had moved through 2 years of his life like a June evening. Days rose up, evenings, like distant, forgotten fireworks suddenly seen beyond the horizon. A bolted, locked, and blood-stained door of his past now opened easily and quietly, and a garden was once more behind it, and no longer the cellar of the Gestapo. Ravitch had been driving for more than an hour. He did not drive back to Paris. He stopped on the bridge which crossed the Seine behind Saint-Germain and threw Harker's keys, his signet ring, and the revolver into the water. He then put down the car top and drove on. He drove through a morning in France. The night was almost forgotten and lay decades behind him. What had happened a few hours ago had become indistinct, and what had been repressed for years arose enigmatically and came close to him, as if no longer separated from him by a chasm. Ravitch did not know what was happening to him. He had thought he would feel empty, tired, indifferent, agitated. He had expected a feeling of disgust, silent justification, a craving for liquor, for getting drunk, forgetting. But not this. He had not expected to feel easy and released as if a padlock had fallen from his past. He looked about. The landscape was slipping by. Processions of poplars lifted on high their torch-like green jubilation. Fields with poppies and cornflowers lay outspread. From bakeries of the small villages came the smell of fresh bread, and children's voices in a schoolhouse rose to the scraping of a violin. What had he been thinking before while passing here? Before, a few hours, ages ago? Where was the glass wall? Where was the feeling of being excluded? Evaporated like mist in the rising sun. He saw the children again playing on the stoops of the houses. He saw sleeping cats and dogs. He saw the bright-coloured laundry hanging in the wind, and the woman was still standing in a meadow with clothespins in her hands, hanging up long rows of shirts. He saw it, and he felt that he belonged to it, more so now than he had many years ago. Something in him melted and arose again, soft and moist. A burnt-over field began to turn green, and a far distortion gradually swung back into a great balance. He was sitting in his car, very quietly. He hardly dared move, not to frighten it away. It grew and grew around him. It circulated downward and upward. He was sitting still and did not believe it yet. Nevertheless, he felt it, and knew that it had come. He expected Harker's shadow to be sitting beside him and staring at him. And now his own life was sitting beside him. It had returned and was looking at him. Two eyes that had been wide open for many years in silent and inexorable entreaty and accusation were closed. A mouth had gained peace, and two arms stretched out in horror were finally lowered. Harker's death had freed Sybil's face from its look of death. For a moment it came alive, and then began to grow indistinct. At last it could have peace, and it sank back. It would never come again now. Poplars and linden trees buried it gently, and then all that remained was summer and the buzzing of bees and a clear, strong, overwakeful tiredness, as if he had not slept for many nights, and now would sleep very long, or would never sleep again. He parked the Talbot in the Rue Poncelet. The moment the motor was silent and he stepped out, he felt how tired he was. It was no longer the relaxed fatigue he had felt during the ride. It was a hollow, empty craving for nothing but sleep. He walked to the Internationale, and it was an effort for him to walk. The sun lay like a beam on his shoulders. He remembered that he must give up his apartment in the Prince de Galles. He had forgotten about it. He was so tired that he wondered for a moment if he might not do it later. Then he forced himself to walk back and drive in a taxi to the Prince de Galles. He almost forgot to ask for his suitcase after he had paid his bill. He waited in the cool hall. To his right, at the bar, a few people were sitting and drinking martinis. He almost fell asleep before the porter came. He gave him a tip and took another taxi. "To the Gare de l'Est," he said. He said it loud enough for the doorman and the porter to hear it distinctly. He had the taxi stop at the corner of the Rue de la Boétie. "I've made a mistake by an hour," he said to the driver. "It's too early. Stop in front of that bistro." He paid, took his suitcase, went to the bistro, and saw the taxi disappear. He went back, hailed another, and drove to the Internationale. There was no one downstairs except a sleeping boy. It was 12 o'clock. The patron was having lunch. Ravitch carried the suitcase to his room. He undressed and turned on the shower. He washed himself long and thoroughly. Then he rubbed himself with alcohol. It refreshed him. He put the suitcase and the things which it contained away. He put on fresh underwear and another suit and went down to Morozov's room.
"I was just coming to see you," Morozov said. "Today is my day off. We could eat at the Prince de Galles."
He fell silent and looked more closely at Ravitch.
"No need now," Ravitch said.
Morozov looked at him. "It's finished," Ravitch said. "This morning. Don't ask questions. I want to sleep."
"Is there anything more you need?"
"Nothing. Everything is done. Luck."
"Where is the car?"
"Rue Poncelet. Everything's in order."
"Nothing else to do?"
"Nothing. All of a sudden I have a terrific headache. I want to sleep. I'll come down later."
"Good. Are you sure there's nothing else to be done?"
"No," Ravitch said. "Nothing more, Boris. It was easy."
"You didn't forget anything?"
"I don't think so. No. I can't go over the whole thing again now. First I must sleep. Later.
Are you going to stay here?"
"Of course."
"All right. Then I'll come down." Ravitch returned to his room. He stood by the window for a while. The lilies of the refugee Wiesenhof shone in the window box below, opposite the grey wall with the blank windows. Everything had come to an end. It was right thus and good and had to be this way, but it had come to an end, and there was no longer anything to do. Nothing was left, nothing before him any more. Tomorrow was a word without meaning. Outside his window, today fell sleepily into nothing. He undressed and washed once more. He held his hands in alcohol for a long time and let them dry in the air. The skin around the joints of his fingers was taut. His head was heavy, and his brain seemed to roll loosely inside it. He got out a hypodermic needle and sterilized it in a small electric boiler on a chair by the window. The water bubbled a while. It reminded him of the brook only. He knocked off the heads of two ampules and drew their contents, clear as water, into the syringe. He made the injection and lay down in his bed. After a while he got his old bathrobe and covered himself with it. He felt as though he were 12 years old and tired and alone in the strange loneliness of growing and of youth. He woke up at dusk. A pale pink hung above the roofs of the houses. Wiesenhof's and Mrs. Goldberg's voices came from below. He could not understand what they said, nor did he want to. He was in the mood of someone who has slept in the afternoon without being accustomed to it, severed from all connections and ripe for a sudden unmotivated suicide. "I wish I could perform an operation now," he thought. "A severe, almost hopeless case." It occurred to him that he had not had anything to eat the whole day. Suddenly he felt desperately hungry. The headache had disappeared. He dressed and went downstairs. Morozov was sitting in his shirt sleeves at the table in his room, solving a chess problem. The room was almost empty. A military coat was hanging on the wall. In one corner was an icon with a light burning before it. In another stood a table with a samovar, in the third a modern refrigerator. It was Morozov's luxury. He kept vodka, food, and beer in it. A Turkoman rug lay by the bed. Morozov got up without saying a word, brought two glasses and a bottle of vodka. He filled the glasses. "Subrovka," he said. Ravitch sat down at the table. "I don't want to drink anything, Boris. I'm damned hungry." "Good. Let's go and have something to eat. Meanwhile," Morozov rummaged in the refrigerator for black Russian bread, cucumbers, butter, and a small box of caviar. "Have this. The caviar is a present from the chef of the Scheherazade. Trustworthy." "Boris," Ravitch said, "let's not behave like actors. I met the man in front of the Osiris, killed him in the Bois, and buried him in Saint-Germain." "Were you seen by anyone?" "No. Not even in front of the Osiris."
"Nowhere?"
"Someone came across the meadow in the Bois when everything was finished. I had Harker in the car. There was nothing to be seen except the car and me vomiting. I might have been drunk or I might have become sick. Not an extraordinary incident."
"What have you done with his things?"
"Buried them, removed the labels and burned them with his papers. I've still got his money and a receipt for his suitcases at the Gare du Nord. He had checked out of his hotel room by then and intended to leave this morning."
"Well, damn it, that was luck. Any traces of blood?"
"No. There was hardly any blood. I've given up my room in the Prince de Galles. My belongings are back here again. It's possible that the people with whom he had dealings here will assume he took the train. If we call for his luggage, there will be no trace of him left here."
"They'll find out in Berlin that he didn't arrive, and they'll investigate back here."
"If his luggage isn't here, they won't know where he has gone."
"They'll know. He hasn't used his sleeping car ticket. Have you burned it?"
"Yes."
"Then burn the receipt for his luggage, too."
"We could send it to the check room and have them send his suitcases to Berlin or somewhere else, collect."
"That amounts to the same thing. It would be better to burn it. If you are too smart, they might suspect more than this way. Now he simply disappeared. That can happen in Paris. They will investigate, and if they are lucky, we'll find out where he was last seen, in the Osiris."
"Were you in there?"
"Yes. For a minute. I saw him. He didn't see me. Then I waited for him outside. No one saw us there." "They might inquire about who was in the Osiris at that time. Roland will recall that you were there."
"I often go there. That doesn't matter."
"It would be better they didn't question you. Refugee without papers. Does Roland know where you are living?
No, but she knows Weber's address. He is the official doctor. Roland will leave her position in a few days.
They'll know where she is.
Morozov filled his glass.
Ravitch, I think you'd better disappear for a few weeks.
Ravitch looked at him.
That's easily said, Boris. Where to? Any place where there is a crowd. Go to Cannes or Deauville. There's a lot going on there now, and you can easily disappear in the crowd. Or to Antibes. You know it, and no one asks for papers there. Then Weber and Roland can always let me know if the police have been inquiring for you to question you as a witness.
Ravitch shook his head. The best thing is to stay where one is and to live as if nothing had happened.
No, not in this case.
Ravitch looked at Morozov. I won't run away. I'll stay here. That's part of it. Don't you understand? Morozov did not reply.
First burn the receipt for his luggage, he said.
Ravitch took the check out of his pocket, lighted it, and let it burn over the ashtray. Morozov took the copper plate and threw the fine ashes out of the window.
So that's done. You've nothing else of his on you.
Money?
Let's see it.
He examined it. There were no markings on it.
You can easily get rid of that. What will you do with it?
I could send it to the Committee for Refugees, anonymously.
Change it tomorrow and send the money in 2 weeks.
Good. Ravitch put the bills into his pocket. Folding them, he realized that he had been eating. He gave his hands a fleeting glance. What strange thoughts he had had that morning. He took another piece of the fresh, dark bread.
Where are we going to eat? Morozov asked.
Anywhere. Morozov looked at him. Ravitch smiled. It was the first time he had smiled.
Boris, he said, don't look at me as a nurse might, expecting me to have a nervous breakdown. I've wiped out a beast that deserved 1,000 times worse. I have killed dozens of people who did not matter to me, and I was decorated for it. And I didn't kill them in fair fight, but sneaked up on them, spied them out from behind when they were unsuspecting, and that was war and honorable. The only thing that was repugnant to me for a few minutes was that I could not first tell Harker to his face, and that was an idiotic desire. He's done with, and he will never again torture anyone, and I've slept on it, and it is as far removed from me as if I were reading about it in the papers. Good. Morozov buttoned his coat. Let's go. I need a drink.
Ravitch looked up. You?
Yes, I, Morozov said. I.
He hesitated a second.
Today, for the first time, I feel old.